Hello and welcome to Everyday Sublime. This is your host, Josh Summers, and it's a real honor and pleasure to have you here. Thank you for your attention. Before I give you today's talk, I want to just mention that this is a free podcast made freely available by the support of a yin yoga-based practice community that my partner Terry and I host. The community is called the Riverbird Sangha, where our loose motto is where we cultivate our energy or cultivate our heart-mind with the one practice with many forms. So there's multiple forms of practice that we explore, primarily embodiment practices that include yin yoga, hence yin-based. But yin yoga, qigong, seated meditation, and yang yoga, those are the four core practices that we share. We've been teaching yin yoga and offering yin yoga trainings for coming up to 20 years now, believe it or not. So this has been a big part of our own cultivation and our own life practice. And we very much appreciate the support of these members in the Sangha making this podcast freely available. If you're interested in joining, if you'd like to have support in your own practice, if you'd like to have access to our library that includes just a great number of tutorials, workshops, but also the archive of our weekly classes where you can dip in and use the filters to select, I want to practice for my upper body, I want to practice for my lower body, I want to do something for the spine, I want to focus on breathing, or I want to focus on something meditative. You can use our filters in the library to fine-tune your practice for every day, and you can practice with us wherever you'd like. So if any of that's of interest, do check us out, the Riverbird Sangha. There's a link for you in the show notes. And just know that we give you a free 2-week trial to test us out to see if we're the right fit. If not, don't worry. You can just unsubscribe and no, nothing lost, as we say. But we will give you, with your membership, a free copy of our ebook, The What, Why, and How of Yin Yoga. And we certainly hope you enjoy the classes in our library. Today's talk, to move into this episode, today's talk is a continued series of talks I'll be giving about how I'm using a beaded garland or a mala or a rosary in my own practice now. For a few months now, I've added the beads to my daily meditations. And quite frankly, I'm very impressed with what they do. I recently heard Jack Kornfield give a Dharma talk about one of my teacher's teachers named Deepama. And Kornfield was saying that they once asked Deepama, what is it like in your head? What's it like? What kinds of thoughts do you have in your head? And Deepama paused for a moment and said, there's just three things in my head. There's concentration, or steadiness, stability, samadhi of mind. She said there's kindness, and there was peace. So concentration, kindness, and peace. And in working with my own self-styled mantra, which I'll guide you through and how to do it yourself in this talk, I've just been finding that those qualities that Deepama had exclusively, those qualities are more and more present in my mind. There's much greater concentration. There's greater kindness engendered by the mantra itself. And there is a sense of overarching peace, even in the midst of pretty difficult world conditions, pretty difficult personal conditions, just life conditions. And I'm eager to share my side of working with mala, or garland, or bead-based practices, and to hear how you experience it too, to see how does it land in your practice, and what do you take from it. But in our Sangha, the people that are able to show up on the Monday session live, who hear this talk as it's delivered, we've all been noticing that there's a deepening of something, and we have different ways of articulating what that is, but there's a deepening of something in the practice as stemming or flowing from the inclusion of just holding a string of beads in our hand. And as I said in my last talk, this is one of the oldest practices, if not the oldest practice that the human species has ever had. I won't get into all the paleoanthropology on that now, but it's fascinating. If you want to look into it more, I consider or recommend that you consider a book by Clark Strand and Perdita Finn called The Way of the Rose. Anyway, that's the talk that's queued up here, and leave me a comment, let me know what you think, leave a review in iTunes, and otherwise, I wish you all my best, have a wonderful day, and I hope you enjoy today's talk. As some of you are aware, we had a late winter, probably early spring snowstorm that came through on a Wednesday evening into all day Thursday last week. And it dumped a lot of wet, heavy snow very rapidly in our area. And on Thursday morning, our lights were out. The power had gone off, which was not a surprise. But when you get a snowstorm that late in the season, it sort of does a few things all at once. Personally, my own psyche, and I know Terry and I are sharing these thoughts back and forth, but after a long winter, we're both really itching for spring. We're looking forward to sun. We're looking forward to having our bare feet on the ground again. We're looking forward to doing yard work outside. And when a storm like that comes in, it's just, we're forced to retreat back indoors. There's just not as much we can do outside. And so there was definitely a sense of stir craziness or cabin fever that was kicking up for us over the weekend. But when we did walk in our neighborhood just after the storm, one of the things that seemed singularly unique about this particular storm was the way that when the heavy snow landed on trees, many of the trees, the boughs would bend way down, and particularly the birch trees. The birch trees the tips of the tree would bend all the way down to the earth. So there's a big sort of arc of a tree coming down to touch the earth as a result of the heavy snow. And I was curious, when would the trees spring back? When would the trees bounce back up to their normal way of standing? And in the few days after the storm passed, I came to see that return, the trees' return to normalcy was influenced by human behavior, and the way it was influenced very dramatically was that the plows that came by and plowed the streets would push a huge amount of wet, heavy snow as a bank onto the side of the street or inside of the road. And if there was a tree that's tip had arced down near the bank, near the side of the road, that pushed heavy snow from the plow would then land on the tip, essentially encrusting it and holding it in place. The tree tip would be held down. So, and this is still going on. So when Terry and I walked our neighborhood yesterday, we articulated that question out loud. When will the trees return to their normal way of standing? And you could see that some of the boughs had freed themselves of the icy bank and were springing back up. They were in the process of literally straightening. And some of them were still caught in snow, caught in the frozenness, caught in the frozen bank. And at one point I said to Terry, I said, if you look at that stretch of trees there in front of us, it's like the fingers of a pianist's hand. Some of the boughs are bent down, curled in, touching the side of the road.
held in place by the bank, and some of the boughs are extending forward like fingers on a pianist's hand. Which is all to say that we had, as you know, many of you know, we had a little disruption last week with our schedule. We weren't able to have our class on Thursday morning or our training session on Friday, and that training session will be rescheduled a week out. And we apologize for not having the Qigong class on Thursday. And I know this is a day that, as I mentioned, a day of celestial significance, of the alignment of the moon passing precisely between the earth and the sun at a certain point today in the afternoon, whereby a total solar eclipse will occur. And I know many who have the means and the ability to be there, many are going to try to be in the line of sight, to line up in a putting their body in a place where they are able to see the total eclipse, to really maybe, and I'm not going to be one of those people. Terry and I won't be. Terry has a standing teaching commitment at midday. So we wouldn't be able to drive into what is called the line of total sight, or the line of total eclipse, which is about 2 hours north of us. But we'll be going to a local state park and climbing up on our modest little mountain nearby and doing the best we can in terms of seeing a partial eclipse. But in my head, in my heart, I hold together these two events, that there's a celestial significant celestial event, which many people will try to see. And I think part of the allure of seeing this once-in-a-lifetime event is, you know, the specialness of it, the fear of missing out. Like, if I miss it, you know, I've missed my chance. So everybody wants to pack their bag and get to a position of ability to see it, if possible. And that specialness, this almost the sacredness of seeing something like that something that special, juxtaposed against a pretty unpleasant storm, which, as we know, is the result of the kind of ongoing climate change as connected to human behavior, that is making our own continuance, our own existence, increasingly fraught, increasingly challenged, increasingly on the road or already over the cliff of real dramatic ecocidal, speciescidal kind of behavior. And I mentioned this just so that we're coming together on the same page in some ways, that I think it's occurring to all of us. At least it's occurring to me. I shouldn't speak for anyone else here other than myself. But for me, it's a daily reflection, and it's a very unsettling, eerie daily reflection to stay present to that fact that wherever we look, we see the climate is striking back in a way, that the earth is coming back and saying, we can't keep doing this. And in our local community, I wanted to add that in our local community, when there's a significant storm like the one we just weathered, and there's wide-scale power outages, and some people are fortunate enough, like we are, to have a generator so that if we need be, we can run our generator and have some power for a few hours to keep our refrigerator relatively cool so food doesn't spoil, keep the plumbing running for a little bit. And there are many that don't have generators, and so when the power goes out, their house goes cold, or their basement, the pump in their basement is no longer able to pump water out, and so basements can flood, to just name a few complications that come when electricity is gone. But Terry kept sharing with me over the weekend on the Facebook, the local, our town's Facebook page, where people share updates and messages with each other. And there was a lot of grumbling about how long it was taking for CMP, Central Maine Power, that's the company that repairs the lines for the most part. There was grumbling about how long it was taking for this company to reinstate and repair power outages. And whenever she would share it with me, I just would sit with it for a moment and think, this is grumbling about that is, at least for me, is the last thing I would do. Every time I think of it, I say a word of thanks and gratitude for the workers that are busily, industriously trying to repair the electricity. But within it all, there's a general trend of how do we get back to what we're comfortable with a growing gnawing sense that what we're comfortable with is not sustainable. Not sustainable. And we're all implicated. And we're all here on electricity. We're all part of we're all on the ship together. And so I'm not trying to make any statement that you should agree with or believe or subscribe to. I'm just opening up a contemplation that's been alive in my heart for a while now. What is the relationship between what we're cultivating, what we're developing in the heart of our practice, and how does what we develop in our practice support our ability to see and to hear and to stay present to the conditions of what life is like right now? So that's the big picture. That's the big question. That's the big question of our practice story. Is how does our practice hold us and support us and I would even add nurture us? How does our practice help us grow into the kind of being that is able to meet and respond and solve and be creative and adaptive and generous and empathic amidst the conditions we're all witnessing? How do we take care of ourselves? How do we take care of each other in a world like this, in a world that's like this? So that's the big question. And I wanted to continue in this session with some thoughts about a tool or an instrument of practice that I introduced last week, which is the use of a garland of beads. And I recommended that if you have beads handy, you know, bring them into these sessions now, or if you'd like to get a wrist mala or a neck mala, like to get a string of beads for yourself, I'd recommend that. I think it's a very, very helpful tool, particularly in the face of the kinds of conditions that I was just describing. And I won't get too much into that today, but I've just been thinking and reading more and more about the impacts of technology and screens and attention spans. And with all of that in the mix, I think anything that can be tangible, a practice that can be literally tangible in your hands, goes a long way to help reestablish a quality of attention, a quality of presence that would be difficult without the instrument, without the tool. And after last week's talk, when I shared about sort of my own history with bead practice and mantra practice, some of you said that you'd participated in mala making parties, bead mala parties, which are common throughout yoga studio culture for a while. People get together with strings and beads, different colored beads, and make their own prayer necklaces or prayer wrist malas. And this isn't going to be that kind of party. This isn't going to be a party where we string beads together today. If you have beads, gather them with you. If you don't, you can use your hand to count and function similarly. But what I want to suggest today is that it's not so much a bead party as it is a seed party. A seed party. And when I think of seeds, particularly at this time of year, where there's a transition from winter to spring in the Northern Hemisphere, if you plant, if you're a grower, if you plant seeds in your garden, the winter, you could say, is a time of considering seed selection. What kind of seeds will get planted? Will we plant vegetables? What kind of vegetables? Will we plant flowers? What kind of flowers? So there's a process of seed selection. And I wanted to open that theme up today, that if you think of mantra practice, mantra is the repetition of a word or a string of words. As I thought about it over the week, wherever I've looked, whether it's in Chinese spirituality from ancient China, ancient Indian spirituality, the spirituality, the mysticism found in theistic religions, it seems to me that one way of describing what a mantra is that it's a word that embodies, it's a word or phrase that articulates, it articulates an alignment with something that's higher. It's a way of aligning one's own perception, a way of aligning one's own attentional field to something that's higher, in the sense that it could be a higher power. So the theistic traditions often use a phrase to align the heart of the individual with a transcendent power, a power that's higher than oneself. And if that flavor of the practice resonates with you, I encourage it. I don't discourage it. You'll find that in not just theistic traditions, you find that kind of devotional practice in very much of part of the yoga tradition. But even if, you know, the idea of a higher power or divine power, or God or goddess, if all that makes your skin start to break out in a strange rash, then I wouldn't recommend that kind of a thought. But the idea of something higher, you could see it in the same way in the prayer or practice of metta or loving kindness, which we see in Buddhism, where the practitioner might say phrases like, may I be happy, may I be safe, may I be peaceful. And those phrases don't, on the face of it, sound like they are supplicating or invoking any higher power. But when we wish ourselves safety, when we wish ourselves health, in a certain sense, we're wishing ourselves something that stretches beyond where we are. Because we experience ourselves as vulnerable to ill health. We experience ourselves as vulnerable to harm. That's our encounter with the world. There's an unpredictable capriciousness to our health, our own safety. A storm like last week just underlines that point. And so when we use phrases in the practice of metta, may I be safe, may I be healthy, we're not appealing to a higher power, but we are reaching our hearts out for something beyond the here and now. We're stretching. And that's the idea of transcendence, is the transcendent stretches beyond what is here and now. So that's what I was trying to get at when I was saying that a mantra, a word, or a series of words, if I look, wherever I look at them, in all the traditions that I've seen, and I invite other people to bring other traditions to the table, but in the traditions that I've looked at, the phrase opens the mind and heart to perceive and maybe receive something beyond the immediacy of what we have before us. And so when I was thinking about the mantras and how they work, and how that when we repeat them with the bead, where one bead at a time, we might recite one phrase or a series of phrases, and then move on to the next bead and repeat those phrases again. When it's done with a collected presence of wholehearted sincerity, I've been thinking about how I've been trying to think through this on many different levels, but one of the things that's occurring is that in that repetition, the very neurons of your brain that are involved in the quote-unquote performance of that repetition, and it's the performance of the words, it's the performance of the inner feeling that the words evoke, it's the awareness and the attention that's aligned behind those words. And all of that comes together. The neurons that are firing hold all of that. They're aligned with all of that. And if you know anything about neuroplasticity, the way the brain can change itself as a result of behavior, thought, and action, neurons that fire together start wiring together. Is the phrase. Neurons that fire together wire together. And I was rereading a book on growing talent. It had nothing to do with spirituality. But the author in the book on talent makes the interesting point that it's not just the firing of the neurons that gets them to wire together. It's the firing that signals to the cells in the area of the brain that produces more myelin. And myelin is like the coating around the wires that insulates them and allows them to become more conductive. So laying down more myelin increases the conductivity of those neural patternings, increasing their ability to fire well. And I just want to say that because even, so if you're a hard-nosed materialist, which I might have been at one point in my life, you're a hard-nosed materialist, this practice is a very simple way of collaborating with your own the dark joker in me would say your own self-lobotomy. You can rewire your brain. You don't have to cut any parts of your brain out, but you're literally rewiring your brain with this practice. In Buddhism, the idea of planting seeds was one that I remember Thich Nhat Hanh and various teachers using, where they said every moment of mindfulness, every time we give our full attention to just what is, practicing mindfulness, when we do that, we're planting seeds in the present. And each moment of mindfulness is just that, a seed planted in the present. Increasing the chances that at some future point in time, that seed will sprout and another experience of mindfulness will burst open. And we can't be sure, we can't be certain when, where, and exactly the planted seed will sprout. But we can start to see that and experience this in our own life, that when we plant regularly, and when we plant seeds, embed seeds regularly into our consciousness, or you could say our unconscious through practice, that's what we're doing with mantra, at some point we start to see spontaneously those seeds sprout. You know, we might find ourselves in a stressful situation and suddenly the phrase comes back to us. You know, I was driving in some traffic on Saturday and starting to feel flustered, and part of my inner committee started to use the phrase, may I be peaceful, may I be safe in this experience. It came online, not because I thought to myself, now would be a good time to start practicing. It just spontaneously came online and brought a lot of comfort. It was like my inner coach, my best inner coach, was suddenly whispering in my ear that there's a better way to be in this traffic jam than getting really pissed off. So I wanted to offer some of those thoughts around seed selection. I want to offer some ideas now around how you, the individual, might think about designing your own seed for your practice, your own contemplative seeds, how to select your own seeds. And I should say that from the outset, if you already have a mantra, if you have been practicing with a tradition of any color or stripe, you've been practicing with a tradition that has a mantra that you like and that works for you and that resonates with your heart, feel free to use that. You don't have to change a thing. But if you're mantra curious, and if you're interested in exploring the power of this practice with some beads in your hand, I wanted to offer just a sketch of guideline around this. You know, these are just some opening suggestions. I want to hear what you guys think and what you make of it. But last week I mentioned that for this month, I'm loosely exploring the theme of an ethical framework for practice, which in Buddhism is known as sila, S-I-L-A, sila. And it's sort of the Buddhist version of the Ten Commandments, or it's the Buddhist version of the yamas and niyamas you see in yoga. Ethical guidelines, ethical frameworks that help support the fertility of our practice. That if we're not ethically oriented in a certain way, we could be scattering as many seeds as we want, but if the ground isn't fertile, if the conditions of our environment aren't right, in the right ethical footing, it's very difficult for the practice to bear fruit or to bear flowering. And most of the time, whenever I've encountered ethical frameworks, they get framed as do's and don'ts, goods and bads. Do this, don't do that. In Buddhism, one listing of these is known as the five training precepts. And generally speaking, when you go to a retreat center, sooner or later, you're encouraged to take the precepts, which means taking on the ethical commitment that for that day and going forward, you're establishing the intention to refrain from certain behaviors that cause suffering for oneself or others. So these are the five major domains of life where, if we're not aware, we can get ourselves in trouble. The five domains of life that can cause challenges for ourselves and others, suffering for ourselves and others. And they're listed as like a refrainment, like refrain from killing. I voluntarily undertake the training to refrain from killing, or I undertake the training to refrain from stealing, or I undertake the training to refrain from sexual misconduct, harming someone else through unskillful sexual energy, or I refrain from speaking in a way that causes harm. I refrain from unwise speech. Or the fifth one is usually related to intoxication, refraining from intoxication, and refraining from ingesting substances that cloud the mind. I'm not the only one to think of this, but the fifth one could also be just seen as consumption, or looking at our consumption patterns, refraining from areas of consumption that cloud the mind. But in general, when we think of all of those, you know, it's a list we tick through, and we might chant it daily to ourselves, and then usually by the end of the day, become overwhelmed by the number of times that we didn't live up to our ideals. I didn't speak well there, or I accidentally stepped on that spider when I didn't mean to, or the bit of cheese in my sandwich is not aligned with the non-harming platform of a vegan diet. Whatever it is, there's always a sense of, I've always had a sense of coming up short, that I'm not ever fully aligned with a self-respectable level of ethical behavior. And that can bring a lot of shame, and with shame, a kind of wet rag on enthusiasm in the sense of practicing with total integrity. There's always a sense of, I've had a sense of kind of compromise integrity from day one with practice. So rather than listing it like that and then suggesting you come with a mantra of great idealism to say, this is the practice that we should all follow, I want to suggest that if you consider that list, killing, you know, harming through behavior, harming through holding on or accumulation or grasping, harming through sexual energy, harming through speech, how we speak, the tone of voice we use, the words we use, the way we articulate our spirit, or harming through consumption. You know, and I can think of just screen use as well within the strike zone of this fifth precept, the, you know, screen use and the harm that it brings to oneself, to our ability to connect and relate. But if you consider all of that, the thought I had for us today in the Sangha is there, when you reflect on it yourself, is there one area where you can say, yeah, you know, that's an area of my life where if I were to bring a little more attention to my speech, or if I were to bring a little more attention to the way I hold on to things, or gather things in, or take things, the way I consume things, that might bring an opportunity to grow. And this is the idea of horticulture here. It's the opportunity to plant seeds and grow from how we are now into a being that does something less and does something else more. So it's not like it's not just a refraining from a certain behavior, but it's actually embracing of a different pattern of behavior at the same time. And so this week, I just wanted to suggest that you can start today, but just consider all these domains of life, whether it's how we relate to the natural world, to our food supply, to each other or to your people in your life through that, you know, our relationships are always are going to involve our speech, how we communicate, how we guard or and or express our life as a sexual being, how our sexual energy might appear or not appear, and how we consume things. But if there's an area where you can identify or see that, well, that might be a field of my life that might be valuable to give a little extra attention to, it's from that kind of reflecting that I would suggest, and this is my recommendation today, is that that's the kind of domain where you could articulate a particular mantra to plant a seed of growth in your own heart. Like if there's something you could do for 15 minutes a day in terms of planting an idea that could sprout into your life, what would it be? And then from the use of imagination to imagine essentially what would life look different, how would life look differently if this growth was, this new evolution of your own being, this new growth was more available. It was available to you more often. And in that spirit, but listening to your own heart for the words that would lay over that intention. But the words become the clothing that are going to drape around the essence of that intention. And so today when we sit quietly, and first I would just say, let your mind settle. Let your mind listen back through some of the themes that I've been sharing, if you can. But then listen into your own heart for what we started to talk about last week, your heart's deepest desire, your heart's deepest aspiration for life, for your life with your loved ones. And it's not so much that from your head you need to create a mantra, it's more from listening from the heart that I think you'll find the words start to bubble up. The words start to come up on their own. And as the words start to assemble themselves before your awareness, then they can be collaborated with and stitched together for a phrase. And, you know, and if you like the sort of the formulaic phrases of metta, may I be safe, may I be healthy, may I live in peace and love. Those can be a starting structure from which you fill in and replace or substitute the language that speaks to you. Or speaks from you is really what it is. What is the language that speaks from you? So what I'm getting at here is this is a form of self-stylized devotion of kindness, compassion, wisdom, where I want to encourage you to articulate and compose words for your deepest aspirations or your deepest aspiration. And then once the words cohere, to take time either with passing one beat at a time through your fingers or and repeating slowly that phrase, or you could trace your your thumb around the knuckles or the joints or the bones of your fingers, really going around from the base of your index finger to the tip of your index finger and around all the bones of your hand for about, it's 12 bones. It gives you 12 opportunities to recite the mantra. And if I'll probably have to go over that finger model a little bit later if you don't have beads with you. But that's what I wanted to suggest today. Those are my morning reflections. I would like to sit quietly now with you for a good 20 minutes and then open it up for shares and reflections and observations and your own stories with it.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed today's talk. Thanks so much for your attention. And again, if you're interested in a 2-week free membership, the free copy of the What, Why, and How of Yin Yoga, check out how you can join the Riverbird Sangha for 2 weeks for free. And we have a sliding fee for monthly membership rates. And whatever membership you choose, you will have unlimited access to our online library of classes, tutorials, and select workshops. So that in itself, particularly if you're a teacher, I want to say this to the yin yoga teachers, you took our training or took someone else's training, but if you're looking for inspiration in your teaching, I can't tell you how many yin yoga teachers say that this is what they use the library for. They'll go into the library over the weekend, look at a few of our classes, practice along with those classes, and then use the themes from our classes in their teaching, keeping their own teaching fresh and current. And we're delighted to hear that. This is we did this with our teachers. I did this with my meditation teachers. This is the way we learn. We imitate, we integrate, and we innovate. To quote the great jazz trumpet player Clark Terry, we imitate those that we aspire to be like. We integrate what they have shared with us and what we've received from them, and then we ultimately innovate that in our own practice. Those are the three I's of jazz improvisation, and they apply directly to our practice, our spiritual life, by any other name. Anyway, have a wonderful week. I look forward to seeing you in the next episode. Stay tuned. I'm going to be dropping some interviews, which I've had on backlog for a while now, and Terry and I are going to be dropping some new Chi Chats coming your way soon. We send our best from Maine. We wish you peace, steadiness of heart, and kindness. And we look forward to connecting soon. Take good care.